It's been 25 years since the movie Scream was released and became an instant hit with critics and audiences around the world. Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson's knowing slasher spawned three sequels and set a young, hip and scary trend that immediately changed the landscape of cinema. Now with a new installment of the record-breaking saga on the way in 2022, this podcast will celebrate the original release and what came next, maybe with a few twists and turns along the way. I'm Alex James and this is the Woodsboro Podcast. Tim Hillman is a location manager. How do you become a location manager? I hear you cry.
I was a musician. I went to Berklee College of Music in Boston, graduated from there. I graduated in 1977. I ended up in Chicago, and I always joked that if I failed as a rock star, I could always sell real estate. And I figured I had to get a real job. So I got my salesperson license and started selling real estate. And then I got my broker's license. And I loved putting the deals together and matching the people up with houses and everything. But I hated the weasels in the real estate business. My sister-in-law was a decorator in Los Angeles. And she said, well, why don't you be a location manager? And I said, okay, what's that? Because I didn't think people got paid to work on movies. I thought you won a lottery and you got to be on set and, you know. And I was lucky enough to get into the business in Chicago. And there were six location managers at that time in Chicago, and they got maybe two big projects a year. And I turned to my wife and said, we have to move to California.
Tim's credentials are impressive to say the least. Here's a few of the movies that he's worked on. National Treasure, Castaway, Magnolia, What Lies Beneath, oh, and only Terminator 3.
Remember the 85-ton crane that drove through the city with Arnold hanging off the boom?
Yeah. And
we did that on city streets, shutting down blocks and blocks and taking an 85-ton crane and making it slide around corners. CG was there. It was very expensive, so we had to do as much of it practically as we possibly could.
Which leads us to here. There's a very special title on Tim's list, and that is, of course, Scream 2. Not that he'd actually seen Scream before the job popped up.
I watched the first film when I was hired to do the sequel. I had been contacted by the producer, and you know, I came home and said to my wife, well, I got to go to, I think at that time, I think I was still going to the video store and renting it, a VHS copy or maybe a DVD. But I watched it that weekend and just cracked up. It was, you know, it scared you to death and made you laugh hysterically at the same time.
So how did Scream 2 end up on Tim's desk?
Well, the producer was looking for a location manager. It really, just because it was a horror film or a horror comedy film, it didn't really matter. You still need a location manager to do the same thing they always do, which is break down the script, figure out where it's going to shoot, and then find the locations. That's the fun part. Mm-hmm. And then make it possible for 200 people to go there for a few days and film. That's the hard part. We started with an idea that many of the cast had TV commitments, you know, friends and things like that. So we could only go out of town for a certain amount of time. And we wanted to find a school with some Gothic architecture that kind of matched UCLA, because we knew when we came back, we were going to spend some time at UCLA doing some of the exteriors, and we actually did a couple of the interiors there as well. So we threw out the big net, and the production designer and I flew to, we went to Duke University, we went to someplace in Ohio, we went to Cal Berkeley, and we ended up at this place in Decatur, Georgia, which is just west of Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And we found Agnes Scott College, which is this women's school, and it matched perfectly. So we ended up going there. We started out by flying up to Berklee because that was one of the contenders.
Yeah.
We looked at that, and while we were there, the designer and the director talked, and he said, we should really look at Alex Scott. So we literally went to the airport. We had to stop at a Macy's because the DP was with us, and he expected it just to be a day trip. and we had to stop at a Macy's so he could buy a clean shirt for the next day. And we flew to Atlanta and went to Agnes Scott, and that was the place.
Did you get a sense straight away that was the one?
I felt it was when Barry and I, the production designer, and I were there. It just felt right, and it was a small enough school that we could control it. The timing was right because they were just going to be ending classes when we arrived, so the campus would be pretty much ours to run amok on.
Yeah,
which was very important to be able to have that control. It felt good, and we knew it would match UCLA quite well.
Was there any, one of the big stories from the first one is the story about the school that they used in California, kind of finding out what the story was and going, this doesn't really fit in terms of the kind of content that we want filming in our school. Was there any kind of pushback, or were they completely welcome in there?
We were very, because of what happened, and poor Eric, he had to go through that on the first one. I mean, I do not envy him one second of that, because that's just a location manager's nightmare.
Yeah.
But we made very sure because of that, that whatever school we went to, we said, look, this is what we're doing. This is, you know, watch the movie. We're doing that again. And there's going to be a lot of blood, and we're going to cut people up and kill them. And you know, mayhem will ensue. So you need to be prepared for this. And please don't let us come there unless you're going to let us film there. And so we had that all cleared before we even set foot on the campus.
And there must have been an element of them realizing the success of the first one.
I think so. They had this wonderful woman there, our liaison there, Mary Zimnick. She was the public relations person at the school. And she was just terrific about getting everybody on board. And she was very excited. And she had some, they didn't have a film program per se, but she had people that were interested in film. So we got them, you know, production assistant jobs while we were there, and let them kind of shadow us and see what went on. So we got great cooperation that way. The campus was isolated enough. The biggest problem we had was the campus was in the flight path of planes taking off out of Atlanta. And, you know, I had to make the phone call, and I got into all the way to the control tower. And I said, is there any, I know it's a matter of physics. I know the wind has to get under the wings for the plane to lift up into the air, but is there any way you could divert to a different runway at least for a few hours? And a couple of times they actually were able to do it because the winds weren't bad, but most times we just got hammered. And that was one of the toughest parts there.
So can you remember, can you tell us what parts were the college and which parts were then back in LA?
Most of the campus was Agnes Scott. We did 3 nights at UCLA, and they were all nights. We did a lecture hall there. We did use a small theater for the, there's the talk show with Tori Spelling, and I can't remember who interviews her, that little bit. And we did the ending where they're running out with the last body over at the student union over at UCLA. But everything else on the campus, especially all the daytime stuff, was done in Atlanta, Decatur.
And was there's this the scene with Sarah Michelle Gellar?
Now, yeah, that's in Altadena, north of Pasadena.
And is that, am I right in thinking that's quite a famous location from a number of other films as well?
Yeah, and Catch Me If You Can, it was the Southern House, and it's been in a lot of films. There was a house that hadn't been in many films, which was the other fraternity house that was on Grand Avenue in Pasadena. That was a really tough one to put together because it was a very wealthy neighborhood, and we wanted to go in there for 3 nights, all night. Dust to dawn.
How do you go about convincing people that you can do this?
Well, you pay them a lot of money and put them up in the Ritz-Carlton.
Do you have to ever, like, you redecorate people's houses or?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, that's part of location management that just always floors me is we'll scout a place and they'll go, this place is perfect. We don't have to change a thing. And the first day of prep, all the furniture is going out of the house. And it's like, well, I thought we didn't have to change a thing. You know, furniture's gone. We're painting walls, you know, putting down rugs. It's okay. I'm glad it was perfect.
How did Tim take the original script for Scream 2 and then bring it to life?
Well, what I always try and do, which I did on this one, is I try and read the script three times before I even start working. Mm-hmm. The first time I read it, just to get the story and find out who did it in the end. The second time I read it for location breakdown. And then I have a list of all the interior and exterior locations, and I can go to the producer and director and designer and say, what are we going to build? Because I have to know what we're going to build right up front. If we're just building the interior of a place, I've got to find the exterior so that the windows and the doors that they put on the set match, or at least come close to matching. And then the third time I read it, just to get it into my head, because first ADs are notorious for spitting out page numbers, scene numbers, you know, slug lines from the script. And I want to try and be as in tune with the script as they are, you know.
Yeah, it's like studying for an exam, yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. And it gets easier as the years go by, but actually, easy is a four-letter word in our business. We don't use it because it always, if you ever say something is easy, it blows up. It never fails. But you see, you haven't gotten to the best part of the interview yet. That would be that yours truly had a role in the film. We were going to Atlanta and we knew it was purely monetary. They wanted to cast crew members as background people so they didn't have to fly those background people to Los Angeles and put them up with housing and per diem to shoot continuations of the scenes at UCLA. So the first AD, who is a very funny man, Nick Mastandrea, in fact, for our rap gift from Wes, who is a brilliant man, and I'll get into more about him in a minute, but
yeah,
Wes's gift to us was a dictionary of Nickisms. Nick used to have these sayings that he would say, like, can't throw a meatball past a hungry dog, or they're working at the speed of a flat rate, or, you know, yeah, even a blind squirrel finds a nut now and then, you know? And he'd have all these sayings that would just constantly come out of his mouth. And we're in the van one day, and they're talking about all these background people they have to hire or create out of the crew. And Nick says, hey, Wes, my nickname at the time was Falling Down. Because if you remember the movie with Michael Douglas, he had the straight, you know, haircut and the horn rim glasses. And I had the same haircut and glasses, so he called me Falling Down. And he said, how about we make Falling Down here the captain of the campus police department? And Wes says, yeah, that's a good idea. I went, yeah, fine. You know. And we're sitting at the read-through in Atlanta when we get there, and the costumer holds up her hand and says, excuse me, but who is this Captain F Down? And I looked at Nick. I went, you didn't. He went, oh, yeah. And, you know, I think they were trying to get back at me because they put me in polyester. Now, we're in Atlanta, Georgia in July.
That would have been very hot, yeah.
And I just melted in this thing. But they, part of my uniform was I had a radio on my hip with an earpiece in, so I could still be the location manager while I was in the scene. You know, I'm listening to all the cues and everything and telling my people where to go. And then we came back to LA and we were doing a scene in the police station. It's the scene where Liev Schreiber is getting his things back because he's been held overnight.
Of course. Yeah.
And that's me handing him his stuff and telling him to sign his name. And Nick comes over to me and goes, hey, yeah, Wes wants to give you a line. And I'm like, yeah, okay. So he gave me a line and I did the line. And Wes comes over and says, say it a little slower. And he looks at me and goes, you're actually really good. You know that? And I cracked up. It was just the funniest thing. But that line has made me, and then we did another scene later on where we're in the hospital. It's Jerry O'Connell, myself, and they actually scripted me a line I got to say the line, and that one line has paid me about $15,000 over the years.
What? No way.
I'm still getting checks.
You know, I was going to say, did you ask for an increased fee on the back of that? But
no. They paid me scale, and then I was Taft Hartley'd, what they call it. If I ever did another part, I'd have to join SAG.
Yeah.
But because I was put on this contract, they have to send me residuals, and I still get $7-8 every 3 months or so. It's going down. I've gotten checks as little as, $2.49. It costs them more to send the check than they can pay me. But
we need to encourage people to watch it some more? Does that help increase the size of your check?
Yes. And look for the bouncing bald head in there. And at the movie theater, at the opening, Popcorn Boy.
Yeah.
The guy that hands out, that's our director of photography, Peter Deming.
Part of this series is, of course, to celebrate the legacy of Wes Craven through the Scream saga. So where does he rank alongside other directors that Tim has worked with?
Wes was just, he's a genius. You know, he's John Hopkins, PhD. He's been a cab driver. He's been a teacher. He's been, he has all this life experience, and he was the nicest man ever. And we were on a scout one day, and he was talking about Kevin Williamson, the writer. And he goes, look at this. We get to the end of the scene, and then he's actually written in here, Wes does some really scary shit here. He says, it's up to me. I have to fix this. And every day when the call sheet came out, on the backside of the call sheet was the New York Times crossword puzzle.
Oh, I've heard about the crosswords, yeah.
And between setups, everyone on set had the crossword out, and they were, hey, what'd you get for five down? And Wes would go, no, do it yourself. Top two, maybe number one. He was just, to watch him work, he was brilliant. He was always very relaxed. I never saw him lose his temper about anything. He had no lofty aspirations. He was there with the crew, and we were all making this film together. He knew he was in charge, and he expected people to do what he asked them to do. But he was great.
Was there any sense of, here we go again with another sequel? Was there just a sense of celebration about how well the first one had done, and it was great to be able to do a second one?
I can't speak for 3, 4, or however many they did, but on 2, we were just having a really good time, and everybody was happy and grateful to be there.
And I guess at that point as well, we were starting to enter that world. I think the more I've read about 3, it became more of an issue in terms of keeping script things off the internet and trying to trick people who were trying to follow the production. Did you get a sense of that? And working in such a wide open space, like a college campus, did you struggle with security, keeping things closed?
We didn't struggle at all because we had a closed set that, we went there when school was out, and the internet was big then, but it wasn't like it is now. It wasn't instantaneous, and people finding out that they can get $10,000 from TMZ if they drop a dime on somebody, we actually did quite well. And our scenes at UCLA, they were at night, and the scenes at these houses were at night, so there weren't a lot of people hanging around, and I had a very good security person who's actually came to Atlanta with us to run the security there. He's been with me for 26 years now, and he kept it safe, and we had enough police and security to gently keep people back and not let them see enough of what was going on that they could figure it out.
Was there anything that surprised you as it went along versus the first time that you saw the script? How much did that evolve? Were there 2 or 3 different endings to the scripts, and only certain people were privy to the actual one?
No, we all kind of knew, and it was, it was very surprising to see it, the turn of events come out the way it did. The theater where it all comes to a head, that was the old Variety Arts Theater in downtown Los Angeles. the front of it was on the UCLA campus, but the interior was in downtown. We almost lost one of our special effects guys because he was in the orchestra pit and we had dry ice smoke coming across the stage. Well, it was falling off the stage and gathering in the orchestra pit, and dry ice smoke is CO2, not oxygen. and he blacked out for a while. We had to get him out of there and get him on some oxygen.
And what about the cast at this point? I mean, in terms of the success, not only from Scream, but then you've got Courtney Cox building this incredible career on Friends, and Neve Campbell going through Party of Five and stuff like that. They'd already kind of established themselves in those things. But I guess if you tied Scream 2 and the peak of popularity with those TV shows, that must have been, they must have just been, their world's just blown apart by their success.
Yeah. And David Arquette and Courtney were dating at the time, you know, about to be married. And it's kind of cute watching them off to the side, you know, having their little conversations, and the cast was, they were there to have a good time. You know, there weren't any real egos. It was great. Liev Schreiber, you know, look how he's blossomed into a career, and he was just brilliant and friendly and the nicest guy. And it was a great experience. One of my best film experiences ever.
That's really nice to hear, yeah, because I can't imagine it's always not using the E word.
Yeah, no, and we had some tough things, like we were shooting in Pasadena outside of the First Christian Science Church, and we had to get their cooperation, and I had it up until about 2 days before we shot there. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be another Eric Klosterman. And they looked at me and said, hey, Eric was great. And I said, no, Eric was great, but Eric got the rug pulled out from under him at the last minute. And I really felt for the guy. And now here we are. And you know, we managed to pull it out of the fire, but that was some heavy duty negotiating.
Was that the same issue? Because they weren't so keen on the content.
Well, we had someone there at the church that had said, oh yes, you can film as long as you're outside, you can film, and this is what we can do, and we can help you with this. And you know, as long as you're not coming inside, which we weren't, we did need to put some lights on their property. Mm-hmm. And it was the scene where the car runs into the K-rail and the pipe goes through the guy's head.
Yeah.
You know, that little scene.
That's a great sequence, that.
Yeah, we got to have a pipe go through the guy's head. Okay. You know, we were able to convince them that we weren't identifying them, which you could kind of make out what the church was when they were coming down the street. But we managed to get it done.
Was there anything Tim learned on the shoot for Scream 2 that he's kept with him during his professional career?
Well, I learned something on every show. We're never, ever done learning, because there's always something. It may be the same thing that you've done before, but there's different players involved and there's different aspects. And so if you ever meet a location manager that says, I know everything there is to know about location management, it's probably the worst location manager in the world, because you're constantly, constantly learning new things. And the one thing I think I took away, I took a few things away from there. I took Wes's attitude on set and tried to strive for that, just the calm, cool, okay, we're in trouble, but we're going to figure this out. So, you know, we're going to get this done. That was his mantra, you know? And the producer that hired me for the show, who I ended up doing four or five pictures with after that, Daniel Loopy, he's a crazy man. He's nuts, but the nicest man, and you know, he and I got along great. We had some knockdown drag out fights over silly things like cell phone bills, because back then you could rack up a $2,000 cell phone bill. It wasn't like it is now, where you can pick up a call and you know, you can call across the country for free, for as long as it's part of your plan. You know, I can't pay $2,000 for a cell phone bill. Well, you know, Daniel was from England and had a very thick accent. Right, I'm not paying this. I'm like, well, then don't call me, because I'm not using my phone. But he was very, very actually very gentle and he wanted to take care of the crew. And he would throw parties. You know, when we were in Atlanta, we had a couple of magnificent parties that Daniel just said, okay, we've worked for 6 days, it's time to blow it out. And he really took care of us and was a good man to work for.
It's funny, isn't it? Because you assume that everybody working on the movies would be a fan of this kind of genre, but that's not always the case.
Not really. Not really. But the Scream movies make me laugh. You know, they scare you. They're really scary. Wes has that. He's got that part down, man. He's got it nailed. But they're also really funny. And there's always a, oh no, they didn't just do that. Did they really? Yes, they did.
Well, you had a big
pipe through the head is a prime example.
Well, also on two, that would have been killing off Randy, who was obviously a fan favorite. How did that play out when you were actually in the process of making that sequence?
There was a lot of hugging that went on after that scene ended, you know, because they knew he wasn't going forward with it. It was great. The whole thing was just great. I mean, people love to be scared. A lot of people really love to be scared. And a lot of people are fans of this type of film. You know, I'm not necessarily one of them, but I'm grateful that I had this experience.
Aside from playing the very important role of Officer Down in Scream 2, is there another moment in the movie that Tim is particularly proud of?
I think the big wide shot of the campus in Atlanta, where they just show you the whole place, mm-hmm. and it's all completely locked down and under control. You know, I was integral in making that happen. You know, it was like, oh, look at that. It worked. It's brilliant. It's just brilliant. Wes was brilliant. And I'm very sorry he passed because I really like that guy.
So there you have it. Lots of love and respect for Wes Craven, of course, and a little insight into life on the set of Scream 2 from Tim Hillman, the man who brought to life that incredible movie and created the atmosphere, the world of Windsor College. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Woodsboro Podcast. Please rate and subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And if you'd like to join the conversation, then you can find more on social media at the Woodsboro Pod. And you can find me on social media too at This Is Alex James.